Chapter 8 is all about reporter's privilege or newsgatherer's privilege. The name is a little bit misleading if we call it reporter's privilege because it isn't just for reporters. It used to be that reporter's privilege laws or newsgatherer's privilege laws or SHIA laws were only applied to reporters, to people who were gathering information for publication in a newspaper or maybe in a broadcast. But increasingly in this new media age, if you will, reporter's privilege laws have been applied to people who are writing screenplays, who are gathering information to write screenplays, who are writing blogs, who are engaging in public relations activities. So it's much more than just reporter's privilege, which is, of course, why I think Dr. Overbeck was prescient in calling it newsgatherer's privilege. Because in the broadest sense, even someone who's doing a documentary is gathering information for news. What is a privilege? It is what we call an evidentiary privilege. Right? Evidentiary comes from evidence. So it is a privilege for certain kinds of people to retain the confidentiality of people with whom they are talking. All right? So it respects confidentiality, you know, traditionally between reporters and sources, but also between other types of people. So for example, a physician-patient relationship has a privilege. A physician cannot be called to testify in court about things that are within the confidentiality of the patient's medical records. Attorney-client is one of the strongest ones. You know, if I say to my attorney, yeah, I killed the guy, all right, my attorney cannot be called and testify, you know, forced to testify on the stand about what I told him. Priest-penitent, that's another privilege where, you know, if I say to the priest, you know, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. Yesterday I killed a guy. The priest cannot be put on the stand and forced to testify about that. And, of course, the spousal privilege is there also. Now, this is a privilege, not a right. Okay, and it's bound by legal rules. Some of you might be thinking, well, why, if I have information about a crime or about wrongdoing, why wouldn't I want to tell the police? And, you know, that's a reasonable outcome to have. It's an ethical question. The legal question arises when you may not want to for some reason. So, for example, let's say that I decide to do a series of stories on, you know, meth labs in Southern California. And I start talking to people who are meth dealers. Now, I don't want to use their names in my stories, but I think it's important that the public understands, you know, the sort of entire drug methamphetamines ring in the Southern California area. So I may not want to bust these people. I might want to give them false names, and I may not want to testify about them in court. And that's the kind of situation where a reporter's privilege or a newsgatherer's privilege usually applies. Okay? It is a limited right. I'm going to say that again, a limited right. That means that it is not absolute, that courts can and do force reporters and other people who are gathering information to provide that information under certain circumstances. Not every state recognizes it, but we have about, I think, well over 30, it might be up to 36 or 37 states that actually have statutes in place called SHIA laws. California is one of them, and a number of other states that have common law or judge law, judge-made rights. Okay? So again, this is not, the things that I'm going to be interested in testing you on are not going to be what you think about SHIA laws, although certainly I'm interested. Some people think that they're unethical in the extreme. However, the law has recognized a limited right under some circumstances to refuse to reveal confidential sources, and that's what I'm going to be testing you on. Little bit of stuff in the news right now. There's been a number of situations at the federal level where reporters have been called to testify about confidential sources they have obtained in their news gathering. One of the more recent ones that's very high profile is that woman there, Judith Miller. She was a New York Times reporter. She was jailed in July of 2005 for refusing to disclose who had told her the identity of a CIA operative who was later found out to be Valerie Plame. She didn't even bother to write an article, but the information was in her notes, and someone else wrote the article, but was able to avoid jail time because Novak's employer negotiated with the police. All right, people were spared from jail, but Judy Miller decided she was going to go to jail, and she did. She sat in jail for 85 days before Scooter Libby, who was her source, called her up in jail and said, "It's silly for you to sit in jail anymore. Go ahead and reveal my name." Okay, so she sat in jail largely to maintain the confidentiality of her source. There are three older cases in your book that talk about additional reporters who have agreed to sit in jail to protect their sources. And it's getting to be a bigger and bigger problem. Right now, we have no such thing as a federal SHIA law. It's been winding its way through the courts, and it keeps getting hung up on the last couple of steps. I'm guessing within the next couple of years we will actually have a federal Shia law. But right now we have no federal Shia law and no federal privilege. Any privilege that exists is state-based, primarily, and in the federal circuits. Okay, let's talk a little bit about criminal cases and privilege. The criminal defendant, as we talked about in Chapter 7, has a big Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. Right? So this is like Chapter 7, and that is a fundamental clash of rights between the First Amendment rights of the press to gather information and the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights of the criminal defendant to obtain a fair, speedy, and impartial trial. But sometimes the prosecution will seek information rather than a defense to make their cases stronger. So it can happen in either way. And again, society does have a compelling interest in deterring and punishing crime, so that needs to be weighed against the right of a journalist to gather and provide confidential information. This is a fairly straightforward chapter. There are only a handful of laws and three or four cases I want you to know, so it's not a very big chapter. But one of the concepts I'd like you to know is contempt of court. If you've watched Boston Legal or Law & Order SVU or CSI Miami, you know about what the contempt power is. The contempt power is the power of a judge essentially to control his or her courtroom. I used to joke, and really I should pull a clip from this, if you've ever watched Boston Legal, the James Spader character is in contempt of court all the time when he mouths off to the judge, okay? If a judge gives you a direct order and you disobey it, the judge may find you in contempt. For example, let's say that I'm a reporter and I say to the judge, Your Honor, I think you're out of line here and blah, 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 blah. And he says, Belmis, sit out. And I flip him the bird, he can find me in contempt. And there are two kinds of contempt. There are direct contempt and indirect contempt. That would be direct contempt. I have disobeyed a direct order from a judge in his or her courtroom. So he or she would have the right to slap me with a fine or slap me in jail. Okay? So if I disobey a direct order from a judge to do a certain thing or to not do a certain thing, that's direct contempt. Indirect contempt is an awful lot like sedition, when you're disrespectful outside the court, disobeying outside courtrooms. So, for example, if, like we talked about in Chapter 7, the judge gags me as a maybe an attorney from talking to the press and I talk to the press, the judge can hit me with an indirect contempt citation. But contempt is the power of the judge to control his or her courtroom. It's basically the fundamental power of the judge to be able to enforce his or her orders on other people. Now, civil contempt is about money. Criminal contempt is about punishment. It's in a sense, it's I'm going to keep you in jail until you obey. It's not really you're in jail because you've done something wrong. You're in jail because you are refusing to obey. But the two major kinds of contempt are direct contempt, which is disobeying a direct order inside the courtroom, and indirect contempt, which is disobeying an order outside or being disrespectful of the judge outside the courtroom. Okay, a couple of cases I want you to know. There is no First Amendment right, really, for reporter's privilege. Let me say that again. There is no First Amendment right of reporter's privilege. And before 1972, which is another date I'm going to kind of ask you to keep in the back of your mind, there was no special privilege between journalists and sources, and there weren't very many Shia laws. However, Brandsburg versus Hayes changed all that. Brandsburg versus Hayes is an aggregation of three cases: Brandsburg, Pappas, and Caldwell. The name gets named for Brandsburg, who happens to be first in the list. Brandsburg was a reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and as part of his reporting, he watched marijuana being made into hash. He promised the people who were doing it that they would be confidential. Paul Pappas and Earl Caldwell, who were reporters, created relationships with the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers is a militant group that was very active in the 1960s and 70s. Sometimes they were engaged in criminal activity. All three of these reporters were called before grand juries and asked to testify about their confidential sources, and all three refused. And they were brought to court for contempt of court, for refusing to reveal their sources. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. This is the first important case of the chapter. And in Brandsburg versus Hayes, the court kind of did a weird thing. It's a weird vote. Okay? Now, the reason it's weird is because we know that the Supreme Court has 9 members on it. And in order for there to be a majority, you need 5 people, 5 members, 5 votes. In this case, the vote was 4-1-4. So there was a very narrow concurrence by Lewis Powell, one of the justices, to say that there is no First Amendment right, and that is still the law. No First Amendment constitutional privilege for reporters. But the reason this case is a weird case is because the majority opinion is less important than the dissent. That's pretty odd. Most of the time we look at majority opinions to guide us. In this case, states have looked toward the dissent. The dissent was written by Justice Potter Stewart, and it provided a three-part test that gave us a structure for determining when privilege should take place. Now again, the majority opinion is still really good law. There is no First Amendment constitutional privilege. But the dissent is used much more than the majority opinion. What's the dissent say? See the little doohickey up there that says test? That's your cue that it is a legal test and will be on the test. First, the government has the burden of proof. I'll say that again. The government has the burden of proof, and it has to demonstrate three things. First, it must demonstrate that the journalist has information that is critical to the decision in the case. So in other words, they have to bring evidence that says, we are relatively certain that the reporter has information that is critical to the outcome in this case. They can't go fishing and hope that they find it. Second, they have to demonstrate that there are no reasonable alternative sources to obtain that information. In other words, they have to have checked around and said the journalist is really the only reasonable source we have to get this information. And finally, the information has to be compelling and overriding importance. Okay? Remember when the law we've talked about words and the importance of words. Compelling and overriding are big words. They're critical words to how we understand the law. If the court says that an information need has to be compelling and overriding, that means it's got to be absolutely essential, absolutely critical. Not just nice to have, but really critical. Okay? Let me give you an example. And the case is discussed in your book. It's a case that comes out of my home state of Minnesota and that I was somewhat involved in. It comes out of a case with the Minnesota Daily, which was my graduate student newspaper. I worked on the Daily for many years. In this case, several years before I actually got to graduate school, there was a protest, and the protest was taking place at the student union. And at the student union, there were some people who were ending up having some sort of argument. The argument was getting a little bit heated, and more people were coming to the union to protest. So the Minnesota Daily got a tip, and a reporter and a photographer, walked down University Avenue from the Daily's offices down to the student union. And sure enough, gathered there was, several hundred people, and it was starting to get kind of rowdy. So the reporter is taking notes and talking to people, and the photographer is snapping pictures, and all of a sudden somebody falls. And I think there was a gunshot also, although nobody was hurt by the gunshot. Somebody falls because someone has pulled out a set of brass knuckles from his or her pocket and caved somebody's face in. It was very ugly. So the guy's nose was broken and sort of pushed into his skull. Very, very critical injury. And of course, the state wants to prosecute that person for, assault. Okay? So fast forward a couple of years, I'm in graduate school, and they finally have determined that they've got a suspect in this case. Okay? I think the guy's name was Walker, although I'm not entirely sure. Okay? We'll pretend that it's Walker for the purposes of the story. So, the prosecution is trying to put together its case. And it wants information about whether or not Mr. Walker was the guy. So they say, well, we know the Minnesota Daily was there because they did a story on it. So they subpoenaed the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Daily at the time, whose name was Michelle Ames, to provide that information to the court. And Michelle said, no, I'm not going to do your work for you. All right? You didn't bother to meet the critical needs that you need to meet under this test. So let's work through the test. First of all, the district attorney was unable to demonstrate that there was material in the archives that was critical to the decision in the case. He was just hoping, because there had been a story in the Minnesota Daily and some pictures, but he had no idea. So he knew he was going to fail on part one. He had also not provided any evidence for part two that he had asked anyone else other than Michelle for that information. There were several hundred people at that protest, and he hadn't bothered to ask any of them. And finally, he may or may not have been able to provide a compelling and overriding public interest in the information. If indeed there had been a photo that showed the brass knuckles coming out of Mr. Walker's pocket, Yes, that would have been compelling and overriding, but simply showing maybe that he was there doesn't necessarily mean anything. So the district attorney knew he wasn't going to make any of these 3 points. Okay? I will never forget this. Michelle Ames, who's about 5'2", little tiny woman. The judge said to her, "Miss Ames, are you going to provide this information or do I have to find you in contempt?" And Michelle Ames sticks her hands out together, getting ready to have cuffs put on her. And we're all sitting in the courtroom going, "Oh, she's going to actually go to jail." But as it turned out, the bailiff is walking over to her to put the cuffs on her, and the district attorney stands up and says, "Never mind. We don't want the information anymore." So that was it. That was it. We all went out afterwards and had a drink, and I asked Michelle, "Do you have that information?" And she said, "Janelle, I'm not going to tell you." So I still don't know whether or not the Minnesota Daily has information that would have either punished the guy or exonerated him. As it turned out, the state was able to find additional evidence, and it was the guy they thought, so he is sitting in jail. But bottom line is, the government has the burden of proof. For no fishing expeditions, no other reasonable alternative sources to obtain the information, and the information has to go to the heart of the matter. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what happened after Brandsburg. That there is Potter Stewart. He's the crafter of the test that was provided in Brandsburg. Courts have often taken this test that was provided in the dissent and applied it. And many Scheel laws also include that test. So in other words, that was a very nicely done test that a lot of courts decided to adapt and adopt. So even though it was in the dissent, it became the most important part of the case. The majority opinion is basically gone. We don't see very many cases that rely primarily on the majority opinion. And it is the dissent that matters. Okay, let's turn to Scheel laws. As I said before, there are about 30 plus states, I think it's up to 36 states, plus the District of Columbia, that have Scheel laws. Just recently this year, Kansas added a Scheel law, and my home state of Wisconsin, which I thought had a very good common law privilege, actually added in a Scheel law. So we're up to 36, 37 states, something like that. Some states have no Scheel law, but recognize a common law privilege. My home state of Minnesota used to be that way. And if you're in Wyoming, you're out of luck. There's no Scheel law, no common law privilege. And the state's Scheel laws vary widely. Some are better than others. Californians happens to be in the California Constitution. Let's talk about it. The California Scheel law, part of the California Constitution, seeks to keep the confidentiality of unnamed sources or unpublished information obtained during news gathering. It applies to publisher, editor, reporter, or other person connected with or employed upon a newspaper, magazine, or other periodical publication, or by a press association or wire service, and a radio or television news reporter or other person connected with or employed upon a radio or television station. And also, likely, stringers, freelancers, and authors. Okay, so everybody plus the kitchen sink is who the California Scheel law applies to. It's a very broadly written law. And it provides protection for the source of any information, even if you didn't promise confidentiality. So if you gather information and it's in your notebooks or in your files, it is protected even if you didn't promise confidentiality to your source. All unpublished information is also privileged. Specific information that is obtained during news gathering but not disclosed to the public is also protected. All notes, outlines, photographs, tapes, or other data of whatever sort. And I would construe that to CD-ROMs and flash drives and online storage systems as well. And finally, the news gatherer's eyewitness observations in a public place. This is something that I think has become a little bit difficult for the state, because that has a big loophole in it. Any of us can now be reporters. In fact, the law doesn't have any tests to be a reporter. Okay? So any of us can go to our computers right now, open up a WordPress document or a Blogspot account, and become a reporter. So that means that even if I'm an eyewitness to a crime, I can blog about it, say I'm a reporter, and not have to testify. So it's a little bit of a loophole. I'm not convinced that it's been exploited too terribly much, and there may be some case law that suggests that if there is a crime taking place that I would have to testify if I'm not employed upon a news organization. I don't know, but it seems to be a little bit of a loophole. California Scheel law, again, applies even if published information is based upon or related to unpublished information. So again, very broad. And it protects against the holding in contempt. Okay? So the California Scheel law, very broadly written, provides an awful lot of protection against contempt, and applies to information obtained during news gathering. All right. So we've talked about Shia laws. We're now going to talk about some exceptions. Now, every single state that has a Shia law has a little bit different interpretation of it. And there are three areas that often get written into laws for the idea of privilege. All right? So many times they will have a balancing test. It's not an absolute privilege. They will adopt Potter Stewart's three-part balancing test, and it's not an absolute privilege. So I can't simply walk into a courtroom and say, hey, I'm a reporter, give me privilege. There are some judges who might do that, but many will use Potter Stewart's test. Second, there are times when you will have to provide the information because the statute exempts certain areas of court cases. For example, if you are alleged to have libeled someone, you may have to provide the information of who you interviewed to defend against the libel case. You can't simply say it's confidential, I'm not going to tell you, because then they have to take it as your word against whoever's suing you. And finally, many, many, many states exempt eyewitness testimony. If you are a reporter and you see a crime going down, you're going to have to testify about it, even if you are reporting on it. All right. Let's talk about the second important case in this chapter. It's Cohen versus Kohl's Media. Happened in my home state of Minnesota, one of my home states of Minnesota, actually when I was living there. It was very hot news at the time. Dan Cohen was kind of a sleazy politician. He gave a phone call to the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press, who are the two major newspapers in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, as well as to a couple other news organizations, and said, have I got a story for you? Let's meet and I'll hook you up. So, all these reporters meet individually with Dan Cohen. And Dan Cohen leans across the table over the cup of coffee and he says, the independent Republican lieutenant governor candidate, who's a woman, 20 years ago was arrested for shoplifting. She shoplifted a $6 lipstick. The reporters are like, yeah? Dan said, you can use this information, but you can't use my name. And in fact, several of the news organizations didn't even think that was important enough to publish. But the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press both said, all right, we promise that we will not publish your name if we publish this information. So they go back to their news organizations, and their editors overrule them. Their editors say, the story here is not the $6 shoplifting of the lipstick. The story here is that Dan Cohen is a weasel. So they publish Dan Cohen's name in association with this story. Dan Cohen loses his job, and he sues. He said, look, I got a promise from these guys. These guys said that they weren't going to publish my information, and I relied on that promise. The Minnesota Supreme Court said, enforcing the promise would be a First Amendment violation. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, what are you smoking, Minnesota Supreme Court? If you make a promise, you must keep a promise. So they overturned the Minnesota Supreme Court and said that the creation of a promise in this case was a form of law called promissory estoppel. It's a fancy Latin term of saying that you make a promise, you keep a promise. It's a law of general applicability. If I make you a promise, I must keep the promise under law. Okay? So, for example, if I say, I'm going to pay you $1,000 if you sell me a working car, and you sell me a car, I pay you the $1,000, and the car doesn't work, you've broken your promise to me, and that is enforceable under the law. Same thing in this case under the law of promissory estoppel. The reporters made a promise to Cohen. They broke the promise, and therefore the law can punish them. And again, the term is promissory estoppel. If you make a promise, you must keep a promise. It applies to everyone. Okay? All right. Final case in this section, in this chapter, is called Zurcher versus Stanford Daily. Not a very good case for the media, but actually got overturned by a law. In Zurcher versus Stanford Daily, the Supreme Court said that newsroom searches did not violate the First Amendment. The Stanford Daily had done the same thing the Minnesota Daily had done. They had gone to a demonstration, taken a bunch of pictures, and done some articles on a protest where police officers were actually assaulted. When they asked for the information, the California Shield Law protected them, right? Because it's Stanford in California. Okay? So, the DA said, well, what can we do? We want this information. We know. We'll get a warrant to search the newsroom. And that's exactly what they did. Now, that's not a picture there. That's a stock picture. But that's essentially what the newsroom looked like. They went through and searched the newsroom, pulled stuff out of files, threw stuff all over the floor, and, you know, obtained some information. The Supreme Court said, we don't see a problem with this. The First Amendment doesn't necessarily say that newsrooms cannot be searched. So newsroom searches skyrocketed. And Congress responded by passing the second important law of this chapter, which is called the Privacy Protection Act. The Privacy Protection Act of 1980 overruled Zurcher, basically, and outlawed most newsroom searches. Officials cannot conduct searches or seizures involving documentary materials except under some circumstances. It might be okay if they believe an individual is involved in a crime to prevent somebody from imminent death, if they have reason to believe that the information is going to be destroyed. Okay? Those are situations under which you can protect your newsroom, or under which the cops can search the newsroom. Right? And they actually have to get a subpoena for a search, not a warrant. And it is appealable and challengeable to get a subpoena. All right? So, in other words, they made it a lot harder for newsrooms to be searched. And most newsroom searches are now out of the question under the Privacy Protection Act. So, again, this chapter is not very difficult. You need to know about the California Shield Law and Shield Laws in general, and the Privacy Protection Act, and three cases, Brandsburg, Cohen, Zurcher. And here's a summary.